Downloads of this show are available on Podomatic.com and the Podomatic mobile app.
I am Velocity Child, and every Friday at the stroke of midnight, ride the broomstick with Fallen Woman, a weekly psychic fusion of forward thoughts, far-out ideas, magical foray, and spellbinding song. Stirring up the cauldron at Radio Free Brooklyn.
You know, there are so many things that we could talk about in terms of how to love a woman. And so what I've chosen is to take three or four of the principles that are like the glue that hold love relationship together. Certainly, the central one, the linchpin, is the life-death-life nature. The second one is the understanding and the discovery of new eroticism in the relationship. In other words, eroticism does not mean sexual arousal per se. What it actually means is being related to another, whether it's related to the lake or the ocean, or related in the way that you decorate your house on the inside, and the way that you relate to your lover. Eros means to be connected to have a kind of relationship that seeks beauty and meaning in the other. So for instance, when people enter a home that has no so-called eros quality to it, what they might find is a chair in the middle of the room and no books on the bookcases and no music in the stereo, and all things are somehow not in austere beauty, but somehow without beauty, without relationship to human beings. Sometimes big public buildings are created without eros, and no one wants to be in them. Sometimes airports and courthouses and so forth are created in such a scale that is not human-like, and therefore no one wants to loiter, no one wants to be there. So the erotic component of relationship means the ability to look, really look, at your lover. And even in the fold of her arm, see all the different colors that she is. And to watch how the highlights in her hair change from season to season, and to see the smallest to the largest about her. And likewise, one lover to the other. The third thing I'd like to talk to you about is the dual nature of women. Now, I think sometimes men have more problem with this than women do, but believe me, I've met an appreciable number of women who really don't understand the feminine nature either. So we'll just start as though we're speaking to people who want to learn. Often women say to me they want men to know them, really know them. But if they do, then they have to teach them something about the deep knowing. And some women say that they're tired. They've already done too much. I'm tired of telling him or her. I don't want to do it anymore. And you know that famous one, if they really loved me, they would already know without my having to tell them what it is that I would like to have. And the good news is that you can have a lovely relationship with the one that you love. And the bad news is that you are never, ever, unless they came with a crystal ball implanted in their left hand, they are never going to know what you need, what you want, until you give off strong enough signals and they have transmitters developed enough to receive them. One of the most important things about women is personified in this story, an African story called Manowi. This version was given to me by Miss V.B. Washington, who was one of the great church mothers where I grew up. There was a man who came to court two sisters who were twins. But their father said, "Oh no, you may not have them in marriage until or unless you can guess their names." So Manowi guessed and guessed, but he could not guess the names of the sisters. And the young woman's father shook his head and sent Manowi away time after time. One day, Manui took his little dog with him on a guessing visit. And the little dog saw that one sister was prettier than the other, but the other sister was sweeter. And though neither sister possessed all virtues, the little dog liked them both very, very much, for they gave him treats and they smiled into his eyes. Manui failed to guess the names of the young women again that day, and he trudged home, trying to think, how can I find out what their names are? But the little dog, who was very loyal to Manui, ran back to the hut of the young women, and there he poked his ear under one of the side walls and heard the women giggling about how handsome and manly Manui was. And the sisters, as they spoke, called each other by name, and the little dog heard, and then he ran as fast as he could back to his master to tell him. But on the way, a lion had left a big bone with a little bit of meat on it near the path, and the tiny dog smelled it immediately. And without another thought, he veered off into the brush, dragging the bone, and there, happily, he licked it and snapped at the bone till all the flavor was gone. And oh, the little dog suddenly remembered that he'd forgotten the task, but unfortunately, he'd also forgotten the names of the young women as well. So back he ran to the twin sisters' hut a second time, and this time it was night. And the young women were oiling each other's arms and legs and readying themselves as though for a celebration. And again the little dog heard them call each other by name, and he hopped up in the air in a fit of delight, and he was racing down the path to the hut of Manui when from the brush came the smell of fresh nutmeg. Now there was nothing more that this little dog loved than nutmeg. And so he took a quick turn off the path, and he sped to where a lovely kumquat pie sat cooling on a log. Well, soon the pie was all gone, and the little dog had lovely nutmeg breath. And as he trotted home with a very full belly, he tried to think of the young women's names. But again, he had forgotten them. And so the little dog raced back to the sisters' hut again, and this time the sisters were readying themselves to be wed. Oh, no, thought the little dog, hardly there's time left. And when the sisters called each other by name, the little dog put the names into his mind, and he sped away and absolutely and resolutely determined that nothing would stop him from delivering the precious two names to Manui right away. And the little dog spied some fresh kill on the trail, but ignored it and vaulted over it. And the little dog for a moment thought he smelled a nice curl of nutmeg on the air, but he ignored it, and he ran toward home and toward his master. But the little dog did not plan for a dark stranger to leap out of the bush and grab him by the neck and shake him so hard his tail almost fell off, for that is what happened. And all the while the stranger shouted, "Tell me those names. What are the names of the young women so I may win them?" And the little dog thought he himself would faint from the tight fist about his neck. But he fought bravely, and he growled, and he scratched, and he kicked, and finally he bit the giant stranger between the fingers, and the little dog's teeth stung like wasps, and the stranger bellowed like a water buffalo, but the little dog would not let go, and the stranger finally ran off into the bush with the little dog dangling from his hand. "Let go, let go, let go of me, little dog. If you let go, I'll let go of you." And the little dog snarled between his teeth, "Do not come back, or you won't see morning ever again." And so the stranger escaped into the bush, moaning as he ran and rubbing his hand. And the little dog proceeded to half hobble and half run down the path to Manui. And even though his pelt was bloody and his jaws ached, the names of the young women were clear in his mind. And he limped up to Manui, beaming. And Manui fell to his knees. "What has happened to you?" And Manui washed the little dog's wounds, and the little dog told him the whole story, and the two names of the young women as well. And Manui raced back to the village of the young women, with the little dog on his shoulders riding high, and the dog's ears flying behind like two horse tails. And when Manui reached the father with the names of his daughters, the twin sisters received Manui, completely dressed to journey with him. They had been waiting for him all along. And that is how Manawi won two of the most beautiful maidens in the Riverland. And all four, the sisters, Manawi, and the little dog, lived in peace together for a long time to come. Crick, crack, crout, now this story's out. Crick, crack, crime, now this story's done. Now, although we could understand the two women in the tale ethnologically as brides-to-be in a polygamous culture and so on, from an archetypal perspective, which is our concern here, this story speaks about the mystery of two powerful feminine forces within a single woman. Again, we take the aspects of the story and apply them as though all of them reside within a single individual psyche. The Manawi story contains all the essential facts for being close to the wildish woman. Manawi, through his faithful dog, guesses the two names, the two natures of the feminine. Anyone close to a wildish woman is in fact in the presence of two women, an outer being and an interior creatura, one who lives in the topside world, one who lives in the world not so easily seeable. The outer being lives by the light of day and is easily observed, and she is often pragmatic and acculturated and very human. The creatura, however, often travels to the surface from far away, often appearing and then as quickly disappearing, yet always leaving behind a feeling, something surprising, original, knowing, or mysterious. So understanding this dual nature in women sometimes causes men and even women themselves to close their eyes and hail heaven for help. The paradox of women's twin nature is that when one side is more cool in feeling tone, often the other side is more hot. And when one side is more lingering and rich relationally, the other may be somewhat glacial and aloof. When one side is more happy and, you might say, elastic, the other may have a restless longing for I know not what, and they are not satisfied. One might be sunny, while the other is bittersweet and wistful. These two women who are one are separate, but conjoined elements, which combine in thousands and thousands of ways. As in the story, and it's not by accident that men and women struggle to find the deeper sides of their nature and they become distracted for any number of reasons, mostly pleasure of various sorts. Some become addicted to those pleasures and stay forever entangled there and never continue with their work. But you see in the story that the little dog is at first distracted by its appetites. Appetites are often charming little forajidos, robbers, dedicated to the theft of time and libido, yours in particular. So when we're on our way to understand the true nature of things, sometimes there's so many distractions and we have to come to terms with resisting them. Otherwise, we'll never know our lover, never be able to get down to the core. In an argument, for instance, you know how people argue. I mean, if you could put a microphone in the house of 100 people for a month's time, assuming they'll have at least one argument during that time, which I think is probably almost status quo, given how closely people live to one another. If you put a microphone in their homes, you would hear the same argument being argued in almost exactly the same words from house to house. These are the distractions on the road. These are the bones with a little bit of meat on it. These are the nutmeg pies, the kumquat pies that are cooling by the side of the road. These are not important. In fact, the argumentation that starts usually something like, what's the matter? Nothing. Come on. What's the matter? Nothing. Now come on, tell me what's the matter. I'm only going to ask you one more time. I said nothing. And so, of course, then the lover begins to leave the room, and the person who is being asked erupts. Well, let me tell you about this and about that and about the other thing, and on and on and on and on. And that is a distraction from the names, the true names of what is going on in that person, in that woman, in that relationship. Because undoubtedly, When she says nothing, that's her outer self answering. And the inner self is holding its secret about what the matter really is, for any number of reasons. And so a wise person, in order to deal with the dual nature of women, and I might add that men also have a dual nature as well, the way to deal with a person with that dual nature is to ask the question in two different ways. How do you feel on the surface about this? And how do you feel deep inside? Two very simple questions. But believe me, they're life-saving questions for most relationships. The more developed the person is in feeling, the more likely they are to be aware of both the interior and the exterior self. You know, it's always been such a puzzle to people. They say, well, where would you like to go? And the person says, oh, anywhere you want, it's fine. And so they go to a movie. And afterward, say, how did you like the movie? Well, I didn't really want to go to a movie. You didn't want to go. Why didn't you tell me? Well, I wanted to, you know, please you, let you do what you wanted to do so you'd be happy. What? What are you talking about? All of this actually can be solved by not going into distractions about who took who where and who's trying to please who, but by saying when the person says, oh, I don't know, you decide. No, leave it up to you. I say, okay, that's your outer answer. Now, what about your inner answer? Would you consult that part and see how you feel? Because much of the time, the inner answer is not exactly the same as the outer one. So in the Manu'i story, there's also a predator. It's the big man who waits at the side of the road for the little dog to come by, and he wants to squeeze the names out of the little dog so that he can go marry the two sisters himself. And one way of looking at this is that there's something inside of our nature that would like to manipulate other people, and that the more knowledge that we have about how the psyche works, the more we can use it, you might say, to not have full relationship, to not have true eros or erotic relationship, but to just have a semblance of it, to peel the pleasure layer off the top and to sustain ourselves only on that and to be gone, whoosh, like Roadrunner once it's over. But you see what happens in the integrity of that little creature, that little dog, is that he bites back. He says, no, you're not going to do this. I'm not going to let you use this information in a way that is superficial and will come to no good. No, no, I'm going to hold on to my knowledge that this is a way of love. This is a way to connect to another person. This is a way that's valuable and that, in fact, I've suffered in order to gain the knowledge. So in the very end, what we see is that there's a little bit of bloodshed that's involved in learning this. You may have to go through three or four arguments or fights or battles with one another. And there may be some blood spilt. You may hobble away wondering, what on earth am I doing here? But the fact of the matter is you are trying to discover the true names of your loved one so that you can call her or him up into consciousness so that you can love each other unimpeded. So, as you may remember at the beginning of this work, we're talking about the four-alarm lover. And although that's hot and that's exciting, there's a lot more to it than just that. So I want to talk to you now about choosing a mate for a lifelong relationship. Over the 22 years that I've been practicing, I've seen over and over again the traits that I think are important in order for people to be able to make a lifelong relationship. There are 12 of them, and they are not in any hierarchical order. And they are these. Choose someone as though you were blind. Close your eyes and see what you can feel of that person, of their kindness, their loyalty, their insight, their devotion, their ability to be concerned with you. their ability to care for themselves as an independent being. Although our culture bases a great deal on what we see with our outer eyes, what we see with our outer seeing, when we look at the object of our love, far more important is what we see with our eyes closed. The second one. If there's one thing that makes the difference between a lifelong lover and a flash in the pan, it's a person who has the ability to learn. There's a saying in Spanish, el ignorante es poco tolerante, and it means those who are without knowledge are often intolerant. Those who cannot learn new ways, see things in new lights, be able to be curious about the world and how things work, how people work, often close up and say, no, it has to be this way and this way only. And for a lifelong relationship, it's better to have someone who can open and perhaps close too, but open and close, gradually learning and evolving. Number three, choose someone who's willing to be like you, both strong and sensitive. You know, there's a quality that women have sometimes. It's a tough, fragile. Tough on the one side and very fragile on the other. They can go to bat for their social action causes and they can fall apart over something that's seemingly small. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about strength in the kind of strength that a tree has, where great winds can whip it, but because it's flexible, even though substantial, it will move back and forth in that wind. It will not bend and break. And in terms of sensitive, I mean the ability to see, to be alert to things around oneself. Now, some people may need a little help with this, but often, somewhere deep in their mind, or sometimes deep in their heart, they already are awake and alert to all these things. They have trouble articulating it. And that is why number two is so important, the ability to learn. Because as you know, you can have all the potential in the world to be kind and loving and devoted and good and most excellent lover ever known to humankind. But if you cannot learn to develop the potential, then nada, nothing. Number four, choose someone who when you hurt them, they feel pain and they are willing to show it. And vice versa. Choose someone who, when they hurt you, they see your pain and they feel sorry. This is very important. There are many ways that people portray pain. Some by clamming up. It's one of the things that tends to drive more extroverted people crazy, is to have a mate who clams up as soon as the chips are down. But it's an expression of pain, and as long as the person is willing to do something within a reasonable amount of time, say 24 hours or so, to communicate and is able to move gradually through that form of pain, then it will be all right. What is worrisome is when you do something that is unkind or unthinking to your mate and they show no reaction. It either means something is wrong with the feeling function in that person, or that they have given up on you, that they will no longer allow themselves to be fully human in your presence. Because so many of us go through relationships, sometimes several, before we find the one that we want to spend the rest of our lives with. Because so many of us are uncertain about what that really even means, because so many of us have been wounded by relationship after relationship that started with high hopes, and somewhere along the line, perhaps by a failure in the mechanics themselves between the two people, fell flatter than a pancake. Because of all of that, it's likely that you will fall in love with someone who's not pristine, who is wounded in some way. So as a result, this ability on their part to show pain, and as important, their ability to perceive your pain and feel for you about it is very important. Because of the nature of relationship, there are times when we will pressure and pinch and even wound one another. And it can't be avoided entirely. But it should not be the same wounding over and over again. Surely people will learn from each time. But because you might say many have saved up so much anger at past lovers, their ability and even willingness to hurt their new lover or their mate may be overgrown. They should be able to stop when they see the pain in the other person's face. Number 5, choose a person who has an inner life, be it woodworking or drawing or writing or religion or meditation or something that they love. Choose someone who's on their own journey and sees you as a partner, as a fellow traveler in that journey. That ability to be merged with one another, yet be entirely separate from one another, is very important. There are times, because this moves also in cycles in relationships, there are times to be merged as though one being, and there are other times to be very far apart from one another. But you might say the bond that's between you, almost like a bond of flesh that grows out of the side of each person. It stretches and stretches. It can stretch for thousands of miles and even for months and months at a time, but it's never broken. That's the kind of relationship you want to have, not one where the stretching breaks the bond or there's never any merging and there's never any clear separation, but some of everything all in its own cycle. Number 6. Choose someone who has similar passions in life to your own. A relationship is for making memories together. It's like a savings account. You do things together. You take, you might say, psychic snapshots of them. You savor them later. They're the glue of the relationship. And you draw on these memories for pleasure's sake and to tease each other. And to remember good times together, but also during hard times. If there is nothing that you really enjoy together, it would be very difficult to make these times with one another. And although relationships most certainly can be built on mutual support of one another in each one's endeavors in the world that are quite different from one another, there also has to be something. Something as simple as lying in the bathtub together. Something as simple as drying your hair outside in the sunshine together. Something like walking around the block every night together. Any of these things, most simple things. I know you're thinking, it's okay if we just brush our teeth together in the morning? Doesn't count quite. It has to be a little bit more than that. Number 7. Choose someone who has similar values about having children, about childbearing, about family members, about roots and roles for women and men and kinds of marriage and money and religion and so forth. As you can see, these are the ideal. Not everyone can meet all of them. Not all of the way, not all of the time, perhaps, and certainly not always at the beginning of a relationship, but you can see where the relationship is headed. Originally, I made this list because I have 3 grown daughters who are 22, 26, and 28 years old. And these were the guidelines that when asked, I gave to them. And I feel that they are the ones that any person who loves another would, sort of as a fairy godmother, wish over their relationships. This choosing of similar values has to do with decreasing the friction in the relationship. And at the very least, if there are different values, these things should be worked out before there's a long-term commitment to the relationship. As much as we're interested in having the phenomenal flying sensation, you might say, of eroticism in our relationship, there must also be pragmatics. When the pragmatics are mostly taken care of, it's much more easy to soar. Number 8. Choose someone who is compassionate. Someone who is willing, who is able to listen, someone who gives equal time. In particular, if you are a driven person, by having a mate who is not quite so driven as you, eventually you will pick up some of their slower rhythm, which actually will be good for you. And by converse means, a mate who is a little laid back, and I'm not talking about a derelict now, I'm talking about a person who's slightly laid back. By being with a mate who is much more out there, they will be quickened in some ways, and there will be a harmony established, a rhythm that's established between the two. My feeling is that most people need to be married at least, or together, at least 8 or 9 years before they have the rhythm entirely worked out. It takes time. Building a miracle. Not a miracle because you stay together. A miracle because of the force at the center of relationship is the profound God of love. Number 9. Choose someone who can laugh at themselves. I remember one time I had bought a fiddle and I was going to take it up again, and I had it sitting at the side of the bed, and for some reason my mate and I had migrated into the bedroom in the midst of an argument, and we were going at it hammer and tongue pretty good. I was giving as good as I was getting, and hopefully it was going somewhere, but we'll never know, because in the midst of the whole thing, my mate grabbed up my fiddle, opened the case, drew out the violin, and began to play it, standing in the middle of the bed, jumping up and down. And of course he couldn't play, but he was playing it anyway. And I began to laugh, because he was trying to play one of those to make fun of the argument that we were having. Well, it was so funny that finally we were down on the floor with each other, laughing and almost crying in each other's arms. And the value of not only having someone who can laugh, but you yourself, who can stop an argument on a dime by making a joke that's not cruel, but that laughs at yourself and the condition and the position that you're finding yourself in with your mate, that is very important. It's a real gift. Well, say you don't have a very jokey partner. Well, then look for someone who can learn, if they don't already know, how to stop an argument in mid-sentence. This takes practice, because there's something inside of us that wants to push us, drive the car right over the edge. I don't care, I'm taking everybody with me in the middle of an argument. But it's a skill well worth waiting for in a person, and if your lover doesn't have it, hopefully, back to number 2, they have the ability to learn. And you too. You have to learn to stop in the middle of a sentence and mutter some sort of apology or stumble around and say, well, I'm just going to probably talk about this later when I've calmed down. You need to be able to do that yourself. So number 10. Being able to overlook certain faults and characteristics. I remember my abuelita telling me that the very things that would cause me to be attracted to my partner, the things that I would think were charming, cute, and desirable, would probably drive me to insanity later on, and she was right. In my first marriage, I thought that the way that he jingled his coins in his pocket of his pants were, oh, it was, I don't know, so charming. And after a couple of years, it wasn't charming anymore. It was almost like having a cow with a cowbell around his neck. I could hear him coming and going all the time. So know what you can live with, and don't be seduced by thinking that something that really is annoying to most other people is really cute because he or she is doing it and he or she is your lover. Chances are that if it's a dramatic thing, if it's a dramatic fault, you'll never be able to overlook it and it'll never be cute. For instance, I'll tell you just what I tell my daughters. There's several things that are intolerable in any relationship, whether it's a marriage, partnership of business, and that is alcoholism, substance abuse, gambling, criminal activity, anything that takes the person away from their true soul life. A person who cannot tell the truth. A person who cannot give fealty. A person who cannot face you after they've made a mistake and who tries to cover it over in a dramatic and large way instead. And this would be starting a relationship on swamp ground. So number 11 is that you be friends, not just lovers. And that's sort of a tired phrase. And you go, well, yeah, I know what that means. It means I like them, not only love them, and so on and so forth. But actually, it means more than that. And one way to judge it is, are you willing to do for your partner what you're willing to do for your girlfriend or for your guy friend? Are you willing to sit and listen? Are you willing to go over in minute detail the things that they would like to talk about or the things that they would like to do? And not that you have to cater to each other forever, because certainly you don't. But in some small ways on a regular basis, yes, absolutely, you must. And so when you think of what you would do for your friends and weigh that against what you would do for your lover, then it will make things clear for you. And the last, and the most important, I think, and sort of the overreaching one of all of these 12, is make sure that when you choose, you're choosing someone who makes your life bigger rather than smaller. That will tell you all you need to know.
Thank you. beauty with a burning violin. Dance me through the panic till I'm gathered safely in. Lift me like an olive branch and be my homeward dove. Dance me to the end of love. Dance me to the end of love. Oh, let me see your beauty when the witnesses are gone. Let me feel the moving like they do in Babylon. Show me slowly what I only know the limits of. Oh, dance me to the end of love. Dance me to the end. Dance me to the wedding now, dance me on and on. Dance me very tenderly and dance me very long. We're both of us beneath our love, we're both of us above. Dance me to the end of love. Dance me to the end of love. Dance me to the children who are asking to be born. Dance me through the curtains that our kisses have outworn. Raise a tent of shelter now, though every thread is torn. Dance me to the end of love.
Better than all the
rest that I need in the summer.
Sunshine or stormy weather, don't you feel me loving you? You in the sunlight or the moonlight, in the dark night when the time's right, don't you feel me loving you? Tonight, when the time's right, don't you feel me loving you? Whenever we're not together, in days of sunshine or stormy weather, don't you feel me loving you?
Upon I am Velocity Child, and every Friday at the stroke of midnight, ride the broomstick with Fallen Woman, stirring up the cauldron at Radio Free Brooklyn.